What's poppin'? It's your boy Darren Green, host of The Darren Green Show, your weekly pop culture podcast and media series hosted by internet personality, yours truly. This show focuses on entertainment news, celebrity gossip, music updates, social media drama, and reality TV discussions, essentially serving as a lively roundup of what's trending in pop culture news. If you like what you hear, check out The Darren Green Show at your preferred podcast platform, or you can just check me out on YouTube. Talk to you soon.
What's going on, everybody? This is James Graham, Master Facts Voice, and you're here for another episode of the Facts Project Podcast. Thank you for being here. Today, we have our very, very, very special guest. We are going all the way over to India. We are here to talk with Aditya Bidikar. Thank you for being here, sir.
Hello. Nice to be here.
Absolutely. So, for I'm sure a lot of people don't necessarily understand that they have read a lot of the comics and a lot of the projects that you've done, because you've been in comics, of course, for as far back as 2015, lettering probably more than 200 projects, and have worked with the likes of
easily
200 to 300 comics in between that time. So you've worked with multitudes of some great creative teams, of course, Ram V, James Tenney in the third, Tate Broomball, Dan Waters, you know. So you've basically run the gauntlet of the multitudes of projects, and now for the very first time, next week, your book is being released. That you, of course, are taking ownership of. This is your project. You're writing this particular story, and it's almost like a full circle moment to you, because you've been a part of a lot of creative teams. And now you're heading this book, and you've had the opportunity to put the creative team together yourself. So how does this essentially feel? Because it's coming up next week.
Yeah. I am definitely very proud of the book. I think we've all done our best. And like I read it a couple of days ago, and I was like, okay, you know what? I wrote it like 10 months ago, like the first script.
Yeah.
And maybe I could think of like a couple of things I could have done better. Mm-hmm. But at that time, and like this is us trying our best. Like, this is just, we've put everything into the book.
Yeah.
So that feels good. And it also feels like a full circle moment for me, because I started out as a writer before I got into lettering. So it's me kind of coming back to something that originally made me fall in love with creation in the first place. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, that's why I'm in a creative career in the first place.
Right.
So it's nice to come back to that. Yeah.
Now, what essentially basically brought you into lettering as you were writing? Like, what basically brought that upon you to be like, okay, somebody just like basically like put you to a task. We're like, hey, you think you could letter this comic for me? And I was like, yeah, sure. And then all of a sudden it was like, man, this looks great. And then you're jumping into like multitudes of projects. We're like, wait, guys, I can actually do this.
Yeah. It was strange, because the first comics I lettered were my own, like the ones I was writing.
Yep.
So I was writing like 4 to 10 pages for this Indian magazine. Mm-hmm. And I found an artist, but I couldn't pay a letterer, basically.
Yeah.
So I decided to learn how to do it myself. And then I realized that I really enjoy it, and that it kind of puts me in touch with creating a comic in a very tangible way, right? Like, you know, it's one thing to write a script, mm-hmm. and then have somebody draw it, but then it's another thing to like actually be the one putting the words on the page.
Yes.
Right. So that I really enjoyed. And actually my first professional lettering job came about because I'd applied to a comic book company in India as a writer. And they said, look, we don't have any writing gigs, but is there something else you can do?
Mm.
And I said, like, look, I letter for fun, but I'm not really a professional. And looking back, it was probably because they couldn't find anybody else. But like the CEO of the company very nicely said, like, look, you don't know if you're professional level until you try, right?
Right.
So let's give it a go. And thankfully, I got to kind of work in Indian comics for a long time and hone my skills before kind of like properly doing it professionally. But yeah, it was writing that brought me to lettering as well.
Mm.
Yeah.
And even so, I mean, you've even had a chance to work on a couple of Stan Lee projects for Marvel.
Very early in my career, not for Marvel, but there's this Indian. So you said I've been working since 2015, but actually I've been working full time in comics since 2013. So my first publication was probably 2015. I think that was probably 18 days or something. Before that, I did a couple of comics, but I still had a day job at the time. Like I was still doing something else and lettering on the side. But 2013, this Indian comic book company called Graphic India, which used to be Virgin Comics, like that's a known name, right? So they hired me as a full-time letterer cum editor, and I lettered a bunch of comics for them. So there was Grant Morrison's 18 Days there, and Stan Lee had created an Indian superhero for them, and that was something I got to letter. So like I got to check off like two big boxes
You
very early in
did
my career.
super early.
Yeah,
So
was nice.
to get into this particular comic, obviously, you've been lettering comics so long, it's the transition to get back into writing has of course was something that you wanted to do. And now with this story in your skin, was it something that you always wanted to tell?
I've had this story in my head for 7 years at least. Yeah, so it was definitely something. I think around 2021 or 2022, I created a bucket list of okay, like I do a lot of ideation in my spare time. I write a lot of notes about stories, but I used to be so busy that I could never work on them, right? So I sat down and I was like, okay, if I had to make a list of okay, these are the stories that I want to tell before I die, like before I'm gone, these stories that I've written need to be out in the world. What would those stories be? So I had something like 20, 25 ideas, but then I kind of like noted all of them down and realized, okay, this one's just like a fun idea, or this one's not really my, like I wouldn't want to write it, I would just want to read it, you know, that kind of thing. And then I honed in on five books where I was like, okay, these are five things that I would like to do before I go, you know, like as a writer, I mean, you know what a bucket list is, right? So yeah, those are my bucket list items. And originally, I started with a different one in 2021, but at the it's a much more sort of ambitious. It's like 250 pages or something like that, book. And I realized that okay, you know what? It was like just after the pandemic. I was still very busy. My dad was sick, so I was like, part of it was like my duties were taking care of him and stuff. So I was like, you know, let me not do this one. Let me do something a little more intimate, something a little, at the time I told myself something a little easier, but then of course once I chose In Your Skin, I was like, okay, I gotta put everything in there that I can, like it has to be, like I have to work as hard on this as anything else. So yeah, that's how like that book happened.
Definitely. Now, of course, the storyline explores the significance of a subgenre as body horror, as a lot of people call it. But it also explores extreme fandom. And at what point does admiration become identity erasure?
Yeah. So, sorry.
No, go ahead.
So that was actually the starting point of the story, the fandom aspect of it. So 2019, 2020, a lot of like Twitch streamers, YouTubers, Instagram influencers, TikTok people, you know, they were dealing with these parasocial relationships with their, like that their fans were like kind of obsessed over them. And they would kind of like the fans would like trace feuds and stuff, like okay, this person is feuding with that person, et cetera, et cetera. And it made me think about like fandom has always been there, right? Like you go a little into the past, like there's Hollywood, there's Bollywood, there's hip hop, there's like music. All of this has its own fandoms, right? But the one that I'm intimate with is Bollywood, because I have watched my friends obsess over Bollywood. Like once in a while we are at a party and like somebody will be like, have you heard the latest Bollywood gossip, et cetera, et cetera. And then as I grew older, I was like, you know what, like if a normal person was doing this wouldn't be particularly scandalous, but like you really tied your identity with this person.
For sure.
So you're offended when this person is not quite what you think they were. Mm-hmm. Right. And that became very fascinating to me, like that aspect. So it started with the fandom thing, and I was watching like the internet aspect of it. And then I was like, hey, I've seen this before. Like, you know, Bollywood's kind of full of this. So let me think about something. Yeah. So it started from
And of course the distinctiveness of turning this into a horror. Now the horror in your skin, is it more about losing yourself or becoming someone else?
I think it's both.
Okay.
Because it starts with the idea, who is the kind of person who would A, spend so much of their life obsessing over somebody else's life,
mm-hmm.
and somebody for whom wanting to become another person is an actual viable option.
Right.
Right. Like somebody who thinks that that will make their life better. Who is this mm-hmm. kind of person?
Mm-hmm.
And this is a person whose hold on their own identity is a little fragile.
Yes.
Right. Like it's there, but it's sort of constantly threatened by the outside world.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so that kind of led me to the character. Like,
for sure. And what does the story suggest about modern celebrity culture and the need to live through other people?
As a storyteller, I'm more interested in questions than answers. Like, mm-hmm. I don't necessarily want to put my opinion in. Like, there's an essay at the back of issue one where, yeah. You know, it kind of gives you the Bollywood context a little bit. It kind of traces Bollywood through Bollywood fandom specifically through the ages.
Yeah.
So I think if you read that essay, you can kind of tell what I feel about this.
Yeah.
But what I feel about this is not necessarily the point of the story. Like, gotcha. I'm not here to offer like, okay, this is what it should be like. This is what it shouldn't be like. Honestly, I feel like there's something just as I think everybody has an instinct for worship, like instinct for religion. Yeah. And of course, like I don't have that. So it's particularly fascinating to me. Like, I'm an atheist, and like the moment I started thinking about it, I realized that, you know what, I don't think this works for me.
Yeah.
But I know that there is something like, you know, when a person is in a vulnerable moment, they'll reach for God, or like when they're in a very happy moment, they'll reach for God, when they feel like they're part of the universe, etc., in a kind of beautiful way.
Mm-hmm.
So just as there is an instinct for that, I think there is an instinct for worship of people.
Yeah, celebrity.
Right. Yeah, like, and that's what a celebrity is, right?
An
like
idol.
Yeah, some kind of idol. Like, take a politician, take an actor, take a sports person, mm-hmm. Take a musician. I find it very fascinating that we look at, let's say, a musician, and then we expect them to have the same cultural opinions as us as well.
Yes.
Right. Like, why is it not enough that they do music? Right. Why? Mm-hmm. So for example, like, once in a while, there'll be an actor interview, and people will be disappointed at how, like let's say the actor doesn't appear too intelligent.
Yeah.
Like, they'll be like, oh, this guy's a himbo, like a moron. Like, what the hell?
Mm-hmm.
And like, but why are you disappointed? They're good at doing the thing that they're supposed to be doing, which is acting.
Exactly.
Right. So I find that very fascinating. And I think there is an instinct for it. Like, we want to take people and kind of like raise them up a little,
mm-hmm.
so that when we are feeling unsure of ourselves, we can like reach for something else.
Yes.
Right.
No, that definitely makes sense.
Yeah. And again, I don't really have that. Like, I mean, I have people whose work I admire. I have people whose opinions I admire. But if suddenly like an idol of mine has a bad opinion, according to me, let's say, I might be disappointed for like a day, but that's not going to like stop me loving their work or whatever, because that's not what I want from them.
Yeah.
Like, I'm supposed to have my opinions. They are not supposed to have my opinions.
Right.
You know?
For sure.
Yeah. So because I don't have these things, I find myself picking at them like, okay, like why do you believe that? Why does this work this way for you?
Yeah.
You know?
And that kind of like takes over the emphasis of Priyanka, the protagonist in this story. Because she,
yeah.
like you said before, she does embody the idea of a parasocial relationship. But she's taken it to the most disturbing extreme way. And pretty much you're obviously using Bollywood as a powerful backdrop in the story. And there's a system that of course Hollywood creates, that Bollywood creates, and it of course churns out like a manufacturer a lot of these celebrities, these idols. It was like the only way that this is going to work, somebody has to idolize you. And then you see them being, of course, being risen up on this pedestal, and then it's like, like, but the way that you basically were able to kind of weave the story, especially through the aspect of body horror, and obviously a lot of people have talked about the movie The Substance. Now, why is body horror an effective genre for exploring identity and obsession?
Okay, I want to first like touch on something about the celebrity aspect of what you just said,
Yes.
which is that specifically, for example, in the studio system of Hollywood, there was this whole practice of like, we are going to stage manage your personality, right? Like, so for example, you read so many stories, like there's a Hollywood Babylon book, I think, right? That talks about a bunch of this. But like, let's say, for example, like gay film stars were not allowed to be gay in public, but like they had to have a, they would be paired with somebody else so that like their image is maintained, etc.
Rock Hudson,
That's
Cary
some
Grant, yeah.
exactly.
Yeah.
That's something that continued in Bollywood till the year 2000 or so. Like the stage management of personality, like there were always rumors swirling around these things and like gossip stuff happening, but a lot of the image of a person was managed.
Yes.
Right. And then it was the internet that kind of broke it to a certain degree, where like suddenly you can't entirely stage manage the image because this person is being seen in public outside of those contexts. But coming back to like body horror and identity, I feel like philosophically, body horror is a way to get down to the fundamentals of what an identity is in the first place. Right, like essentially like my consciousness is electric impulses floating in a soup inside whatever this is. Right. And the thing that separates me from the rest of the world is my skin. Right. Like physically, this membrane, which is what, maybe like 1 millimeter or something, kind of separates, like keeps me from falling apart, essentially, right? Like,
Pretty much.
right. So we've had different ways of thinking about it. Like, there's this idea of the Boltzmann brain, if you've heard of it, which is that essentially, like electric impulses kind of together could spontaneously form a brain, like a mind, right? Like Alan Moore wrote a really funny story about that in his collection, Illuminations. But so, like, there's different ways of thinking about this sort of idea of like there's the Cartesian dualism idea of it, like mind body dualism, which I do not believe in at all, because like once you experience something like, okay, I've been depressed for 3 days, but then I realize that I've not been eating properly, that is why I've been depressed. So like like that, the degree to which your body affects your mind, and so there's no separation here. So then it becomes interesting to think about, okay, like let's say these are two people and there are two bodies. What is it that keeps them from just like mixing together?
Yeah.
Right.
What is the
Philosophically,
separation?
what is the separation? Right. And that kind of is where the body horror becomes interesting, to kind of talk about this idea that, okay, if this person is so obsessed with being this other person, what is the thing that stops them from being that? And what if that gets torn apart, or that gets
Yeah.
like that problem gets solved, essentially, right?
For
Like that's
sure.
the la like that's what you read in the story, where like, okay, what happens when Priyanka is able to dissolve this separation?
Yeah.
All right, so then there's the rest of the story, which I wouldn't rather spoil,
Now
but yeah.
that there's an interesting correlation amongst Priyanka, and of course Aisha, who she idolizes. Is Priyanka, and I don't even want to describe her as that. Is Priyanka a villain? Is she a victim? Or is she kind of somewhere in between?
I do not see her as a
I don't
villain at
see her
all.
as a villain.
Like I don't think I could write her properly if I saw her as that.
Right.
Right. Like I think I told Eric at some point of time that I don't necessarily like I would like other people to be sympathetic towards her in some way or the other, but I
I did.
don't need them to be because I am going to be. You know, like I care about her enough that for everybody else, essentially.
And that's kind
But
of
I'm
that.
glad that you had that reaction as well.
Yeah, that like of course when you see it in the beginning, like you read a couple of panels and you're real you kind of see it early, where you're realizing, but like this woman is torn, you know, like between her own living conditions and this person that she sees on a TV. Now, obviously, everything is pretty much triggered by Aisha's retirement. How does Aisha's retirement trigger the conflict in this? And how does it represent symbolically? It's like, if she retires, I'm never going to see her on this ever again. This is my perfection. But yet it's kind of like the pivotal breaking point in the story to where that announcement happens and then phew.
I think it's both those things. Like, there's two things happening there. One is that she gets the opportunity to actually meet her, and then something happens there. And that plus the retirement, I feel together are the other trigger for whatever happens next. Like, I don't think one of them. I don't think just one of them would be enough of it. Like it has to be a certain. Okay, I'm sort of like now analyzing my own work, which I would generally prefer not to do.
Sorry.
But that's okay. But like, I feel like you can't feel despair without the potential for happiness, and you can't feel happiness without the potential for despair.
It's the where is darkness without light? Where's light without
Yeah,
darkness? Yeah.
right. So that potential for happiness that was there for a little bit, you know, that is what can cause the despair. Again, this is sort of in you. I mean, maybe real life doesn't quite work that way. Like, but this is what the story construction. When you're thinking about it as a story, that's how you maybe think about it.
And
So yeah.
also even the aspect of that, we're looking at it one-sided, of course, from Priyanka's point of view. But do Priyanka and Aisha kind of mirror each other in the most unexpected ways?
You'll find out an issue too.
I figured that that was going to be spoiler. Sorry.
It's not really spoiler. I think I can say that, but because issue two starts with how Aisha got there.
Yeah. And
Yeah, to the same place.
when we talked about the retirement, it was like, okay, this person wants to get away from this life. Or better yet, this is just a way out. But in Priyanka's case, it's like somebody's got to take her place. Maybe it's me. Right? How does and here's the other part. It's kind of like, what does Aisha's perspective add about aging, relevance, loss of control in her celebrity life. Like, how does this perspective add to it?
You're speaking like you've already read issue two, honestly. Like this is exactly like again, I don't want to spell things out, but Priyanka's perception of Aisha's life is not necessarily accurate. Right. And that's something that you hopefully get to see. Like, just as hopefully you've been sympathetic to Priyanka in issue one, I hope that when you read issue two, you feel
The
at least the
same.
same way towards Aisha. Because that's the thing. Like, while Priyanka is the sort of main character, she's also not necessarily the protagonist. It's like
Yeah, it's
both of
both.
them together make up the story. Because I don't. Okay, so this is the way I describe. Like, I think we've described enough of the story that I can say this part, which is that one of the ways in which I describe the story is that you know what a doppelganger story is, right?
Yes.
Right, like it's the substance, a different man, like there's a bunch of them, the double, where like for some reason, like a double comes into your life and you are sort of like pushed out of it. This is a doppelganger story from the point of view of the doppelganger.
Yes.
Right. Like that's what Priyanka is in this
Like
case.
Face Off.
Yeah. So like most stories like this would start with Ayesha. Right. Here you start with the other person, essentially.
No, I love it. Now, because you're a letterer by trade, does your background as a letterer influence the pacing and the page design? You got four issues.
There's one page in issue one that would not be written like that if I wasn't a letterer. And I think you might be able to guess which page that is. But other than that, I have had editors tell me that I write like a letterer in the sense of like I call out like the visual aspects of the dialogue in the script. So like I remember like I was writing a story a long time ago and like all the electric dialogue is italicized. And the editor was like, hey, that's actually nice to be able to like see that thing here. And like even when somebody's growling, somebody like it's like like there are people who write a screenplay like a writer, and there are people who write a screenplay like a director. So I write scripts like a letter, essentially.
For sure.
Yeah. So it influences the pacing for sure, because I think I have a pretty good sense of how dialogue and silence is read in a comic because I've done it so many times. And like I know that depending on how much familiarity the reader has with the art form, the amount of time taken to read a silent panel is different. So you're very thoughtful about deploying the like essentially like there are people who said this like space is time essentially in comics. So like the bigger the thing, the more important. Okay, like space is time and space is significance. Right. So the bigger the thing, it's like it's taking more time, but it's also the bigger the thing, the more important it is. Right. And that's something that as a letterer, you get to really feel every day of your work because you're getting to see how like you're suddenly like, okay, these three pages are silent. Why are they silent? I was lettering World Tree number 20 the other day, and there's like okay, I lettered page 19 and then I'm lettering page 24. Then I'm like, okay, hang on, I need to read what happens in 20 to 23.
And see, I get that aspect because we're talking about how basically your turn as a letterer has basically secured spacing and pacing, but yet this is four issues. So it's like, okay, now I have to format it to shape the intensity of the narrative because it's not like I don't have to like push the story out a lot farther, make the narrative a lot broader. Even though my whole thing is pacing, I do have to construct a lot of the conflicts that are happening between every single issue, and notably, basically, put a lot of the intensity into every single issue.
That came out of more than my work as a letterer, that came out of my collaborations with people. So Ram V and I have, like, throughout our careers, we talk a lot. And early on, especially, like, I would be much more brash about telling him, like, hey, I think you're kind of doing this a little, like you could do this other thing and that might work. So like as a letterer, I think one of the nice things about me as a letterer for my collaborators is that I have opinions on things that are other than literary. Right. Because I'm a storyteller, like I mean I for clients for whom that would be annoying, I don't offer those opinions. But for clients who are my friends, like Ram and Dennis and Dan, we will chat and we will talk about these things. And then we'll actually have back and forths about it. And like a key thing about like Ram is fantastic with structure. Like I don't know any other comic book writer who understands structure better. And I hope that some of that is rubbed off. Where the more when I was thinking about the story, it was like, so for example, issue one is 34 pages, issue two is 32 pages, issue three is 24 pages, and issue four is going to be either shorter or about as much. And that's due to the structure. Like that's how the story is paced, right? Like it kind of starts out a certain way and then it kind of changes and then it kind of essentially you have two threads that then start mixing. And then the mix will read a certain way. And then of course like there's the climax and denouement and et cetera. Right. So that is down to the structure. So like those things that you're asking are largely my decision making has been influenced by what I like to read and what I like to watch. One of my favorite things. So I watch a lot of movies in film festivals, and there's a point at which, like, I have a friend who I watch them with, and there's a point at which both of us look at our watches, and it's not because we are bored. It's because we both think that, oh, that's the half point of the movie. And then we look to see whether we are correct. Right. And it's delightful to find a movie where we can't predict that.
Sequencing.
Right. Exactly. So like that's so like you want readers to kind of follow you through, but you also want to wrong foot them a little because that's what I like. Like I enjoy not knowing where a story is going. That's my favorite thing about stories these days, where if I can't tell what you're going to do next, that's I'm on the edge of my seat, right? It doesn't have to be action, it doesn't have to be anything. It's just that because I've read so many stories, worked on so many stories, written so many stories, it's just like I live and breathe this. So what I enjoy is surprise, but not surprise in a like a cheap way. Surprise in this way where I don't know what's going to happen next. Like I have no idea,
Definitely.
right? So like I want readers to feel like that a little bit. Like
Oh,
I'm
yeah.
sure there'll be people. No, I knew exactly where this is going, but I would be like, did you know how it is going to happen? So it's all
That's
of
where I think
those.
most of my clues are. It's like I feel that this could be the way that this could go, but I'm not sure how it's going to happen. For sure.
And that's fun. And part of that is the way the characters are written. So I do not. I know there's a lot of arguments online and sometimes even when people meet about like good and bad people and gray characters, et cetera, et cetera. And I feel like all of those arguments are simplifications, right? They're a rigid way to understand something that's much more fluid, right? There's no such thing as a good or a bad person, right?
Of
Like
course.
there's things that people do and there are choices that people make. And yes, we have agreed in moral society that some things are good, some things are bad. But then there are people who do a lot of small bad things, and there are people who do like one big bad thing. Like, okay, who's worse? Like you're not gonna think about it. That's not how anybody thinks. So I would rather not think of characters that way either. Like I would rather not think, oh, this is the good guy, this is the bad guy. Oh, and then therefore, if the good guy wins, it's a happy ending. If the bad guy wins, it's a tragedy. Like that's not how I think about stories.
No, I totally get it.
So I hope that shows as well. And finally, a lot of the way I've written this is reacting to Soames' artwork.
I was going to ask you about that because what I've seen so far from him, it's been amazing. The
He's phenomenal. He's absolutely I, like he's. We just wrapped issue three, right? The art for issue like today. Like
Oh,
I got the final page
I
of
just saw
issue
the
three
cover.
today.
I saw the solicit for issue three, and I'm like, Jesus Christ.
Issue three goes hard. But like I got the last page of issue three today, and like there are these three or four pages which have been living in my head for like 6, 7 years, and I've seen them for the first time today. And it was such a delight. It was like, oh, this person is doing so much more than I was even thinking about. Right. And like not only can he draw phenomenally well, he's also a storyteller. Like he's also a writer. And he's a visual storyteller. Like he's directed an animated movie. He does production design. So he's very aware of how environment affects a story, how body language affects a story. So The moment we started working together, I was like, oh, I have to up my game, because like if I'm expecting this person to be interested in drawing the story, this has to be something that like I have to be doing something that would be at least as good as they would write themselves, right?
No,
Right, like
no,
that's my
for
challenge. I
sure.
mean, honestly, like, it's a personal challenge. So I'm like it's like, okay, it's like if you have an artist who writes their own thing, why should they draw your story rather than something they wrote? You have to give
Course.
them a good reason,
Oh, yeah.
right? So that really made me like up my own visual interest in the story, the pacing. We Soham and I had a lot of conversations about pacing and like how panel juxtapositions work and how pages work in front of each other and so on. And I'm like, oh, all of this has to show in the story.
Now, where exactly did, for this being your first comic and you wanted like a great artist to basically be a part of this project, where did you find some? Or he did
So
he
Soham and
find
I,
you?
no, I found him.
Okay.
I called him up and I said like, hey, I would love to meet up and like I'd like to pitch you this thing. So I've known him for a fairly long time. Like we both met at a party like 15 years ago, and then both thought the other had forgotten about it, so we just never mentioned it again.
Okay.
But like recently we were chatting and he was like, hey, do you remember that we met like 15 years ago? And I'm like, yeah, I remember, I thought you'd forgotten. But we talked about comics. He was, I think, a painter at the time and doing concept art and stuff. And I was like, hey, I think you'd be really great in comics.
That makes sense. He seems like a
Yes.
painter, like the way he's doing these pages.
Yeah. He's not trained as a fine artist, but like I would say he can go toe to toe with any fine artist
Yeah.
on those things. And then after that, like we have a bunch of mutual friends as well, like Anand RK, who drew Blue and Green and stuff. Like he's a mutual friend. So his name would come up a lot in conversations. Then when we were discussing this story, Eric and I, like I think we had revised the outline and we were now starting to, okay, like I'm gonna be writing the script soon. And we started batting names around and he was like, hey, are you aware of this guy? And I was like, wait, I know this guy, like he's Indian. And he's like, yeah, I know. He just finished a comic called Crocodile Black. I was like, oh, Soham is doing comics now. That's so nice. So can we please make him our first choice? Because if Soham is doing the comic, I know he's gonna come in with. So he's worked in Bollywood. I didn't know that at the time actually, but I knew that he lived in Bombay and that he had a phenomenal control of like anatomy, figures, environments, and so on. And then I read Crocodile Black, and I was like, okay, this guy can take care of it. Fine. So then I met him. And I pitched him the story, and his first response was like, oh, like I work in Bollywood. And I was like, oh, what do you mean? He's like, yeah, I've done like concept art, VFX, production design for the last 10 years.
Okay.
And like, hang on, so have you been on film sets? And he's like, yeah, like I'm on film sets all the time. So I'm like, oh, so I can stop doing research. Because like he lives that world. Like I
Right,
don't have to explain anything to
the
him.
stars aligned.
Yeah, exactly. Like I already knew that an Indian artist would have a lot of the cultural context that I'm drawing from,
Yeah.
but Soham is A, he has experience of the industry, and B, he loves for environments to reflect characters, and like he's putting in a lot of work on those lines that I didn't even specify in the script. Like there's a ton of work that Soham is doing with the environments that doesn't come from me.
Yeah.
Like it's just all him.
As
And
well as
he's
the
just
color, as well as
phenomenal
the
at that.
coloring, the coloring
Yeah,
and
like
the
Francesco. Yeah, like I worked with him for the first time on Dawn Runner with
Yeah.
Ram and Evan. And yeah, like he was a great choice. Like we just like he's taken inspiration from a lot of different places and kind of like worked the color palette with us in a very cool way. And like he also is just like he's just a very friendly, enthusiastic person. So like I actually get to hear his reactions on the script and the art and stuff, and it's really nice.
Excellent, excellent. Now, I mean, as far as like the audience, obviously you've got some really Of course, high profile friends. Now, who have you shared the script with? Or better yet, even the first issue? And what was the reception?
So thankfully, like I've been sharing the first issue around, like around my collaborators and other people that I thought might be interested, and thankfully we've got like really great, great responses. Like
Good.
Chip Zdarsky, for example, said like, I'm literally gonna print this out and put it on my studio wall on down days, because he was like, Aditya is proving that he's gonna be one of our great writers too, and I'm like, oh. Like Chip Zdarsky is saying that, like, shit. Okay, is that then true? Does that mean that's true? You know, so I like anytime I feel bad about my writing, I'm just gonna look at that. We've gotten great responses, but very early on, like Ram read like the first draft of issue one,
yeah,
and has been giving me like feedback since then. Like a couple of scenes changed a little bit after we chatted. But also, like, he read the first outline and he kind of helped me hone in on certain things. Like, there was a bunch of like, plot stuff that I was like, oh, I think this is important. And he was like, yeah, like, but why is it there? And then, can you do the same thing in other ways? Can you do the same thing, by opening up a scene rather than like doing plot? Mm-hmm. You know? So, like, I kind of, after that conversation, I kind of like pulled the plot apart and just looked at every piece of it and figured out, okay, this is the important bit. This is the important bit. So like it really like focused the story in a certain way. Then Juni Ba has been reading, like he's read every version of the story. Like he's read all the outlines. He's read all the scripts. He's read all my like rough lettering versions. Like his patience is
you found a confidant
commendable.
Juni.
Exactly. Yeah. Like Juni and I chat anyway. Like we have a phone call every week or so, and like he tells me about what he's doing. I tell him about what I'm doing, and like he's just been through every part of the story at this point.
Gotcha.
And once I lettered the first issue, I sent it to Hassan as well to basically be like, hey, do you have any like lettering notes for me? Like, because I can't look at my own lettering objectively. So yeah. could you just have a look at this and tell me like what I could be doing, kind of thing. That was a great conversation. Tate read the book and really liked it. I think I wouldn't necessarily send the unfinished thing to too many people.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like there it's better to send it to like one person to just say like, okay, this is where it's at. What do you think? Mm-hmm. And then once you've got it like 80% of the way through, then you send it to somebody else and say like, this is where it's at. What do you think? And then once it's done, you can send it to more people, I feel.
Right.
Where they can catch some of the smaller stuff and they can kind of like, okay, or they can tell you like something really big that you didn't realize was a problem. And I think, thankfully that didn't happen. Thankfully, like everybody was like, oh, this works.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. But I mean, everybody loves Soam's art, which is like, obviously, you're gonna love it.
Artwork is, I mean, just covers alone, you know, usually like, obviously as somebody that's like a retailer is putting those on the shelves, it's going to stick out.
I hope so.
Yeah,
I do hope so. Like even the logo, Dylan Todd did such a fantastic job with the logo, and it kind of does something over the four issues that you'll have to keep an eye on.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, the design that's basically built into the comic itself is absolutely phenomenal.
Yeah, but that's also something that it's a way I think about it, because I can't think about just the story. I have to think about like, okay, this is the cover. Then you turn the page, what happens? Then you turn the page, what happens?
Right.
Like that's how I think about it. Right. Like, so here it's like there's the cover, you turn the page, there's the credits and there's this poster. Then you turn the page and then you're in the story. So that was important to me. You know, like I don't think I could think of a comic any other way. I think Hickman's East of West like really influenced how I think about design in comics, where the design is part of the pacing.
That's a good comparison, right? Like, narrative.
Yeah, like I mean, I directly read those massive compendiums, and I don't think I could quite tell you where an issue ends and where the next one begins.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's got so many of these pacing breaks happening. But because of that, like everything reads like a chapter. And then something very interesting he does is that there'll be like you'll turn the page and there's a two-page design spread. And then you turn the page and there's a two-page scene. And then you turn the page thinking that, oh, the scene is going to go on, but no, it's done. Right. That's not something you can do without those design spreads. Right. Without those design spreads, that scene wouldn't read as so separated like from the rest of the thing. You wouldn't feel like you got a breather in the middle. Right. So that's something that I've kind of carried with me that I would eventually hope to use in something else. Let's see.
That's amazing. Well, for one, I definitely like to say congratulations, of course, with the release that's going to happen next week. I hope that everybody enjoys the reception that I was able to read. Obviously, a lot of us comic podcasters, we got a chance to talk about it, and I'm absolutely elated to the fact that this is of course dropping next week. Obviously, I got my copies on hold, so they'll be arriving shortly. But
Thank you so much.
yes, I thank you for the conversation. This has been absolutely fantastic. For the next coming works, I believe you're doing a graphic novel. You're doing The Cutting Garden.
Yes. We finished The Cutting Garden a while ago, like, but because it's a graphic novel, it's got a much longer publishing timeline. But yeah, like The Cutting Garden is coming out in September. Then we've got Decidium, which is Ram's new book that I
That's it.
think like it's gonna be out on Free Comic Book Day. Like there's gonna be a preview
Okay, like an issue
out.
zero.
No, it's gonna be a preview of the first book, but
Okay.
it's gonna be like 10-15 pages, like
Got you.
properly.
Wow. Yeah, that no, I saw the I think I saw the press release for like the beginning of that, and that's phenomenal as well. Jesus.
That's gonna be fantastic. That's gonna be like largely black and white, pretty much.
Which is great because Evan Cagle is, I mean, his work is otherworldly. Dawn
Exactly.
Runner
And
as
I
well
love
as
black and
New
white
Gods.
comics as well.
Yes.
Exactly. Dawn Runner, New Gods, and this is gonna be, I think he did a couple of issues of Catwoman as well with Ram. So like he's gonna do this like phenomenal work. Just like I've been looking at the pages and they're great. Anand is going to draw the second year of it. So, like, Evan's drawing the first three graphic novels, and then Anand draws the next three.
That's
Kind of thing.
great. I say recently comics has generated a little bit of a boom, especially in a lot of like indie titles and from a lot of like publishers like Image and like Mad Cave and everything like that. And I just love to see what's happening,
Oh,
especially
absolutely.
the fact that you're included in this. This makes it a little bit better.
No, it's been fun. And thank you. Like this was, you had some great questions. I had a ball having this conversation.
Not a problem.
I think it's, I've had a few interviews now and like I kind of like getting into these aspects of the story where like, okay, there's just the little stuff. Like the big stuff is all established, like people mostly know about it. So let's kind of get into the nitty-gritty.
Yeah.
That's really fun.
I appreciate the
And
fact that
I'm
I'm able to get I'm I appreciate the fact that I'm able to just am able to ask those questions.
No, thank you. You had great questions. I also I wouldn't say I'm like it is my first big book. So what people will think about it is a bit of a question mark. Like I wouldn't necessarily say I'm nervous about it, but it's a like I'm not 100% sure what it's gonna be like. So it's very nice to have like firstly like people in the industry reading it and then like podcasters and like people like you who read it and then had so many questions. Right. Like I like that the work generated those questions.
When you have a genuine curiosity about your story, I mean, it can only essentially mean a couple of things. It's like I need it's one, I need to know more. And like how much can I get out of this person so that I can know more?
I'm so glad to hear that. Like this story and these people have been living in my head for a very long time,
They're good
and
to
I'm
get out.
about to finish. Yeah, like, and I'm about to finish the fourth script in a
Okay.
couple of days.
Good.
So that's gonna be interesting. Like, what I'm gonna feel like when it's all out, you
Gonna
know? So I'm looking forward to it, but I think I'll be a little bit sad as well.
Absolutely. Well,
Like 2 years from now, I'm gonna call up some and say, like, oh, we could have done that on that
oh,
page
that's the
efficiently.
thing. The second guessing is going to happen once all four issues are out.
But even there, like, Ram had some great advice for me. That, like, we were talking about how something goes from like an idea to a book. And I said, like, look, okay, you've got this like perfect luminous object in your head, and then you put it on paper, and it doesn't contain everything that you wanted it to contain, right? And he was like, you know, there's no need to think about it like that. Once it's on the page, you can look at the thing on the page. Stop thinking about the thing you had in your head, and just think about what's on the page and how you can, like, how best you can present it and how you can make it better. And I was like, oh, that's quite a smart look at it. So I'm gonna, I've been like, I think issue 2 and 3 especially, like, it really helped because there were so many versions of the outline that there were so many things that we could be doing to this with the story. And then by the time I was writing issue 2 and 3, because we'd had that conversation, rather than trying to see chase those other rabbit holes, I was able to focus on, like, okay, here's what we've made, and then how best does it reflect what I want to say, and like, how could I say the thing that this thing is saying better?
Oh, for sure. For sure. Well, I can't wait to see it. Once again, it's been a pleasure to have this conversation with you.
Same.
Obviously, In Your Skin is going to release next week on the 22nd. For Image Comics, four issues that, of course, you, Assam, and Francesco Sagala have had the opportunity to put together. And I feel as though it's worthwhile, and I can't wait to have issue one in my hands.
Thank you so much. And I'm very excited to have the book out in the world.
Absolutely. So for all of us here at the Facts Project, our host, James Boyce, Adya Bidikar, live from India. Of course, thank you again for this wonderful talk and for this wonderful book. And I hope that everybody gets a chance to get it in their hands next week. April 22nd, of course, it releases once again. And we will see you guys next time on the Facts Project. We are out.